I want to welcome everyone here to the Second Court of Appeals. This is our afternoon session, 1:30 session, and it's kind of unusual to have visitors, particularly so many. Thank you for coming. It's nice to have people see us work. I would like to introduce, for those of you who have not been here before, Justice Lee Gabriel on my right, and Justice Bonnie Sutherth on my left, and I'm Justice Ann Gardner, and we are very happy to have you here today. I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm sure you're anxious to. Are the lawyers ready to argue? To present? All right. Good. Well, I will ask our clerk to call the docket, the first case, and introduce the lawyers. All right. Mr. Toby, are you ready? Okay. Come forward, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and thank you. My name is Danny Toby, and today I'll be speaking on behalf of the Episcopal parties who are plaintiffs and appellants in this case. With me is Ms. Mary Costell, who is counsel to the Episcopal Church, as well as Ms. Sandy Leiser. Mr. Tom Leatherberry is counsel to the local Episcopal parties, and Mr. Frank Hill is counsel to the local Episcopal congregations. If time permits, Your Honors, I'd like to address three points. The first is that the trial court went past the fundamental limits set forth by the Texas Supreme Court in both Masterson and the opinion in this case, the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth. That is an error that the U.S. Supreme Court has referred to as, quote, fatal to the judgment. It will be our submission, Your Honors, that applying the rules set forth by Masterson to the undisputed facts that both defendants and plaintiffs both agree with warrants rendition in favor of the Episcopal parties in this case. The second argument I'd like to reach is putting aside that threshold error. The Masterson Court mandated that Texas courts apply neutral principles of secular law to property disputes within certain limitations. Putting aside the threshold error that the trial court went past those limitations, we will argue that even under basic principles of Texas law, the trial court erred in its application, and I'll give three examples of those instances. The third thing I'd like to reach, if time permits, is what we are asking this court to do today. And in short, what we are asking for is that this court reverse the trial court's judgment, enter summary judgment on behalf of plaintiffs, and render the declarations and injunctions that the trial court should have entered, which would return the property to the Episcopal parties.
This would be a permanent injunction.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The first point I would like to address is Masterson and the limits of a proper neutral principles analysis. As this court is well aware, the Texas Supreme Court in 2013 set the rules of the road for church property cases like this one in Texas. And it set forth in Masterson and then incorporated into our case, Episcopal Diocese, a very simple but important jurisdictional rule for how courts should address these issues. Courts are to apply the same neutral principles of Texas law to all non-ecclesiastical questions, including questions about property, deeds, title, all the things we would normally look at in a property dispute. On the other hand, civil courts are forbidden from reversing the church on ecclesiastical issues, such as who may control a religious body, such as a diocese or a congregation. And the Masterson Court struck a very important balance between those two principles. It said that in some instances, it may prove to be the case that if the parties arrange their affairs so that the neutral principles analysis turns on or is affected by an ecclesiastical question, on that ecclesiastical question alone, courts are constitutionally required under the First Amendment to accept and apply the church's determination, not of the property dispute, but just of that ecclesiastical question. And here's the quote from Masterson that is exactly on point, page 607. Property ownership is not an ecclesiastical issue and does not invoke deference, quote, unless the parties have arranged their affairs so that ecclesiastical issues effectively determine the property issue in question. After the Supreme Court set the rules of the road, it determined that neither party prevailed on the record before it. The neutral principal's deeds and other documents were not in the record, the record was not complete, and all the neutral principal's theories were not articulated. So the Texas Supreme Court remanded the case for development of a factual record under the neutral principal's guidance that the court had provided. But it gave a specific caveat. It said, and this is from our case, Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth, page 652, who is or can be a member in good standing of a diocese is an ecclesiastical question. That is a bright line area that civil courts simply cannot go. Same thing in Masterson. The court observed that what happens to the relationship between a lower church body and the higher church bodies of a hierarchical church when even a majority votes to disaffiliate, that is a question of internal church government that is fundamentally ecclesiastical. And the quote that Masterson used, courts are constitutionally required to defer to the highest authority of the hierarchical church, not as to property, but only as to those very specific ecclesiastical questions, even if they effectively determine the property question. So the reason we're before you now talking about those limits, Your Honors, is plaintiffs and defendants have agreed on remand to a certain set of facts that show that this case falls fundamentally under that important exception that Masterson spent so many pages detailing. The facts are these, and I'm going to state them as defendants did in their appellee's brief to this court, because that may be the simplest reference. First, this case is governed by neutral principles of law. The parties agree that under Masterson that is the case. Second, under that neutral principles analysis, no deference, no religious issues, looking at the deeds and church charters and other neutral principles instruments, there is a legally enforceable trust. A corporation is the trustee, but it holds all that property merely as a trustee for the benefit of the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth and its congregations. That is, and again, to quote defendants, the same continuing entities that have used that property for 32 years. So we agree. Both sides agree on those undisputed facts. To cabin an issue off, we also, on the plaintiff's side, believe that there's a trust interest for the national church, but we're not addressing that now. Right now, taking the undisputed facts that both sides agree to, we know that under neutral principles, there is a legally enforceable trust, and we know that the beneficiary is the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth and its congregations. That leaves only one question left for this court and for the trial court to enforce that trust under neutral principles, and that is who is entitled to control the diocese, that is, the beneficiary of that trust. On that question, there is absolutely no doubt that that is an ecclesiastical opinion, a question. It's a question of internal church governance. Masterson quoted a U.S. Supreme Court case called Milivojevic, which I know the court is well familiar with, and it quoted Milivojevic seven times on this point of when an ecclesiastical issue turns up within a neutral principles analysis. And that case is very on point because it involved a dissident bishop within another hierarchical church who disagreed with opinions of the higher church, broke away, claimed to separate, quote, separate the diocese from the mother church, end quote, from Milivojevic. And then when the higher church defrocked that bishop and reorganized his former diocese into three separate dioceses, he told the civil courts that was beyond the authority of the higher church's governing documents to do so. The Illinois Supreme Court applied what we in Texas and in our Supreme Court has called a purported neutral principles analysis, because it used neutral principles of associations law and corporations law to decide not just the property questions, but whether the diocese broke away and whether the higher church exceeded its authority in making the diocese stay within the church and recognizing the disaffiliation as void. And the U.S. Supreme Court reversed and said the fallacy fatal to that judgment in the purported neutral principles analysis was that the trial court substituted its own judgment for that of the higher church as to who is the bishop in the diocese. That's what happened here, Your Honor. It's the same fatal fallacy. Now, defendants in their briefing, and we may hear the same today, proposed that this court, like the trial court, should apply neutral principles of Texas law to the question of who is the diocese. They say it's a simple matter of applying Texas associations law. That opinion cannot be squared with Masterson, It cannot be squared with Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth, and it cannot be squared with Milivojevic, the U.S. Supreme Court case which Masterson and Episcopal Diocese rely so heavily on. As those cases made clear, it's a simple matter of jurisdiction and a place where civil courts cannot second-guess the Church. So to end this section, Your Honor, under Masterson, we would submit that the trial court committed that same fatal flaw as in Milivojevic, the same flaw that the Texas Supreme Court warned against. And the Texas Supreme Court said, they were very clear, they said, here are the types of issues that are ecclesiastical. Here's what you do if an ecclesiastical issue comes up within the case. But they said, on the record before it in 2013, they did not know if there would be a nexus between the neutral principles analysis and one of these ecclesiastical issues. So they remanded the case. But now the record is clear. We agree with defendants on a certain set of facts that show that the way the parties arrange their affairs turns ultimately on who may control the diocese and whether the diocese did break away and leave the Episcopal Church, or, as we submit, that was a nullity beyond the diocese's authority as a matter of church governance, and so the trust remains where it always has, which is for the diocese of the Episcopal Diocese and the authorized leaders. So on that basis alone, we submit that this court need go no further, because on the undisputed record and on the absolutely crystal clear distinction between what civil courts can and cannot do under Masterson, rendition is appropriate. The second point I'll discuss is neutral principles, and I'll give three examples. There's one thing I won't discuss in this section, and I'll explain why, and that's leadership of the corporation. As this court knows, there are two separate entities, and everybody agrees this. There's the corporation, which is a secular property-holding corporation, and then there is the diocese, which is an unincorporated religious body under the Episcopal Church. Defendants have spent much of the case arguing about who controls the diocese, but we would submit respectfully that that is a red herring as a matter of law, because the parties agree, and everybody's on record, that at most, the corporation is a mere trustee that is administering a trust that is legally enforceable under Texas law in favor of a religious body, a separate body, the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth. And so, if the court agrees with us, whether under Masterson or any of the other theories I'll discuss, about who controls the diocese, then who controls the corporation is a non-issue. It's merely a trustee that is not acting in accord with its obligations to administer plaintiff's beneficiary trust.
But the property is in the corporation?
That's the legal title to the property was transferred in 1984 to the corporation, correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the judgment in that case says that transfer of legal title was transferred to the corporation. And defendants have conceded, and I don't think we'll hear differently today, that the corporation holds legal title as a trustee for the benefit of the diocese and its corporations. So in our briefs, we have an analysis under the corporate bylaws of why defendants are not entitled to control the corporation, but we won't waste, unless the court wants us to engage in that, limited time and argument on those issues, because ultimately control of the diocese will determine this case. Associations law, Your Honor. So defendants have submitted that should be the yardstick by which control of the diocese is measured. And as you know, we submit that that's contrary to Masterson. But even under associations law, a subordinate unit of a organization, an unincorporated association, cannot break away and take property absent an express right to do so. And that analysis, as this court has noted in Hardin versus Colonial Country Club, begins with the bedrock principle of associations law, that associations are entitled to administer and interpret their own rules as long as they don't act totally unreasonably or contrary to public policy. So for over 100 years, the Episcopal Church, even viewing it as a secular association, has always held that dioceses are part and parcel of the larger organization and do not have any kind of right of secession. I'll go quickly, Your Honor, as my time's short. There's only one rule for dioceses to exit in the Episcopal Church, and that is a non-territorial diocese with the advance consent of the Church. Defendants do not qualify for that. They're not a non-territorial diocese, and they did not have advance consent of the Church. They rely instead on an implied right, but that's a matter of interpretation, and for over 100 years, going back to the 1840s, the treatises on canon law have said there is no implied right of secession for territorial dioceses. That's the organization's consistent interpretation from that date all the way up until 2008 when they purported to break away. The association has repeatedly voted that to be the case. It doesn't have to be the best interpretation. As Colonial Country Club said, it only has to be reasonable. And it's certainly reasonable for an organization to say subordinate dioceses created by the largesse and permission of the higher organization don't have an implied right to break away absent express authority. It's not inconsistent with Texas policy because, as this court held in Simpson, the default rule is there are no implied powers of a subordinate body absent an express right from the larger association that gave it its writ of existence. Finally, I'll talk about Shelburg. There's a trust in favor of the National Church. I would direct the court to CR 176350. Defendants signed on creation of the diocese with seven pages of signatures, a document saying that they would abide by the rules of the church, which included a trust clause. Under Shelburg, which is uncontested law in Texas, cited by every trust law authority in the state, Johansson, Vernon's, Bogart's from out of state, the restatement of trust third, they've all said that this court's ruling in Shelburg makes that contractual trust binding and irrevocable. It's contractual because under international pressmen, a organization's binding original charter documents are a contract enforceable in court, and a trust supported by consideration, as this court found in Shelburg, which was the governing rule in place, is that such trusts are irrevocable. Finally, there are 55 deeds in the record with express trusts for the National Church. Those are available at CR 38133340 and 100730. And we ask this court to reverse, to grant summary judgment on behalf of plaintiffs, and to enter the injunctions and declarations that we requested. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Brister.
Scott Brister with Andrews Kurth, here with my co-counsel, Mr. Sharp. Mr. Weaver represent the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth and their related officers and congregations. I usually don't argue appeals with one hand tied behind my back, but rotator cuff surgery 3 weeks ago, and we didn't want to postpone. The case has been going on for 7 years, and it's not this court's fault. I've never had a court grant oral argument so quickly after briefing was completed. We're grateful to the court for doing that. In 1979, the Supreme Court of the United States said in Jones versus Wolfe, at any time before a church dispute erupts, the parties can ensure who gets the property, and civil courts will be bound to give effect to the result indicated by the parties, provided it is embodied in some legally cognizable form. In 2013, the Supreme Court of the state of Texas said in this case, this very case, under the neutral principles methodology, ownership of disputed property is to be determined by considering evidence such as deeds to the properties, terms of the local church charter, including articles and bylaws, and relevant provisions of the governing documents of the general church. Now, what you just heard from the plaintiffs is none of that. It's not based on deeds. It's not based on church charters. It's based on, it's all ecclesiastical issue.
I have a question.
Yes.
In considering the rules of the church, and what was the second thing you said?
The deeds to the properties, and then the rules of the two churches, and of course state law.
Okay. Under the appellant's argument, wouldn't our consideration of the rules of the church be stepping over into consideration of ecclesiastical issues?
No. And that's what Jones versus Wolfe, that where neutral principles started, there was one question in that case. Deed said, this property belongs to the Vineville Presbyterian Church. And the court said, the only question presented by this case is which faction of a formally united congregation is entitled to possess and enjoy the church property. There can be little doubt about the general authority of civil courts to resolve this question. So the issue in that case was, which faction is the Vineville Presbyterian Church? That's the case where they adopted neutral principles. Their argument is, oh, it's too ecclesiastical to decide what the church is and what the diocese is. That's where neutral principles was adopted. The Texas Supreme Court in 2012, they made all these arguments before to the Texas Supreme Court. In their brief in March 20, 2012, they said, the church has made determinations about the true bishops, leaders, and diocese, and these determinations resolve the property issue. That's in their brief at the Supreme Court at page 15, which, of course, is word for word for what they're arguing now. If
the
these
Supreme
were all...
Supreme Court didn't really reject that. They just simply said, based upon the record that was before them, they couldn't make a decision.
But the deeds was the only thing that wasn't in the record. All the charters, both the national church and the diocese, were before the church. If they believed that it was an ecclesiastical question, and this is what Judge Chubb said at the hearing, if they believed you were right, that this is all ecclesiastical, why would they have remanded it? And there is no answer to that. It is true that there can be ecclesiastical questions, but the cases mentioned by my opposing counsel, in Milly Vojevich, the document said the corporation, the corporate document said, the corporation's to be controlled by the diocesan bishop of the Serbian Orthodox Church. If our document said it's to be controlled by the Episcopal bishop of in the Fort Worth area, that would be an ecclesiastical question, but that's not what it says. It says it's to be controlled, it says if there's a dispute about that, it's to be decided by the bishop of the entity now known as the Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth. That's a legal entity. It's not an ecclesiastical question about who's been elected by that entity. That's a property question. So let me skip to that, if I can. So on associations, the Texas Supreme Court said, I mean, the argument was made, who's head of the corporation? You can't change that because that's an ecclesiastical question. And the Supreme Court of Texas said no. The corporation was incorporated pursuant to Texas corporation law, and that law dictates how the corporation can be operated, including determining the terms of officers and directors. So now we're dealing here, the diocese is an association formed under Texas law. So what law governs Texas associations? The answer has to be the same, Texas association law. And as we've cited in our brief, at footnotes 63 and 64, in response to the local political parties, Texas Supreme Court, I'm quoting, the Constitution and bylaws of a voluntary association, whether incorporated or not, are controlling to its internal management. So whether it's a corporate nonprofit or an association nonprofit, its rules, its charters, in this case, its constitution and canons, control it. So what does the there's no dispute about what the diocese constitution and charter say. They say the diocese is governed by its convention. They say the convention is governed by majority vote. And the majority vote voted 80% of the delegates in 2000 and 2008 voted for the defendants to be as officers. So the question is straightforward, looking at the Texas law, which says the diocese rules govern, what rule here says a group that's 20% can leave, hold a second convention, and say, everybody we just elected different officers. Y'all are all out of work. Think about it this way. The NFL is an association. The NBA is an association, unincorporated. The NCAA is an unincorporated association. What keeps three guys on an ESPN commentary show or down at a bar from deciding who's going to be in the playoffs? What would we do if three guys showed up and said we represent the NCAA, no matter how important or well-known they were? What would we do? We would look to the rules of the NCAA and ask them, were you elected according to these rules? The problem for the plaintiffs is, the reason they skip over all that, is the only person that can call a convention to order is the existing bishop or standing committee. So if a small group wants to call a convention, they can't do it. They can't walk out, form a new convention, and elect all different officers because they don't have anybody who can, according to the diocese's rules, call a convention. So that's their problem. They don't have a chicken or an egg. There's no way they can get started on that. I think it's, so two things I want to hit just briefly. One is, you'll notice, we're not fighting about legal title. They concede, they didn't for 7 years, but they now concede legal titles all in the corporation. They argued for 7 years the National Church has a trust interest under the Dennis Canon. Texas Supreme Court held in Masterness in this case, that's a revocable trust. We revoked it in 1989. There's no contest about that. So what's the trust they're relying on? They say, it was very interesting, Mr. Toby in his argument said, to quote the defendants, there's a trust for the diocese and the local churches of the diocese. If you read the briefs, that's all they say where this trust comes to. The reason is because that trust comes from a document. That trust, the trust for the local churches is not in any deed. None of these old deeds create a church, a trust for local churches. Nothing in the Episcopal Church creates a trust for local churches. Dennis Cannon did not create a trust for local churches. The only place that puts a beneficial interest in local churches is in the diocese constitution since 1982. And the reason, the court should ask Mr. Toby, so you're here arguing on this trust for the local churches. Where do you say it came from? Because the answer is, it's only one place. The diocese constitution and charters, and the diocese constitution and charters explain exactly who it means. So what happens is the diocese's constitution charter says the corporation holds it for parish and mission, both of which are capitalized terms. Let's see if I can find that page. I can give you this express site. Here it is. It's tough with just one hand. Canon 14 says the corporation holds property for the use and benefit of a parish or mission. Parish is capitalized P, mission is capitalized M. So it means something special. What does it mean special? Canon 31.1 in the diocese's rules. Any parish or mission, capitalized P and M, may organize a corporation for use in administrative affairs with the following requirements. Any such corporation shall merely be an adjunct or instrumentality. The parish, capital P, or mission, capital N, itself, being the body in union with the convention, shall not be incorporated. So, yes, for instance, All Saints Church has a corporation. But under the diocese's rules, since it was formed in 1982 that all the churches agreed to, the parish and mission we hold the property for is not for a corporate parish or mission. It's for the unincorporated association in union with the convention. That's what the document creating the trust says. So who's the body in union with the convention? Well, that's Article 2 of the Constitution of the Diocese. Every parish or mission in union with the convention shall be entitled to delegates determined by the number of confirmed communicants. So if you have an unincorporated association, the parish or mission itself has to be unincorporated. It cannot be incorporated. It can't be a partnership. It's an unincorporated association. That's the church we're holding it for. They have to be in union with the convention, our convention, the diocese's convention. And people, they admit, none of their people have been to our convention since 2008. None of their organizations are in union with our convention. They've had a separate convention from 2009 on. So the only parishes and missions, the only trust is for parishes and missions, and according to the document creating that trust, that's only parishes and missions in union with the diocese. That doesn't take any ecclesiastical call. We don't have to decide any opinion about that. The U.S. Supreme Court in Wolf versus Jones said, look, there is a duty on churches to organize their property rules any way they want. But don't tell us, don't put your property rules one way and then come tell us, pay no attention to that. That's what their argument is here. There's only one trust, and it's defined for the parishes and union, missions in union with the diocese. I mentioned Milo Vigevich said that the core documents in that case said for the diocesan bishop of the Serbian Orthodox Church in Kedrov, the deed granted the use to the Archbishop of the Russian Orthodox Church in accordance with the doctrine, discipline, worship of the Holy Apostolic Catholic Church. Yes, if the deeds or charters said it belongs to a church official without defining it. Now, again, in the corporation, and this is interesting, so can only be one diocese. For property purposes, yes. For church purposes, religious purpose, no. You can have as many as you want. And my proof of that is every Sunday, all kinds of Protestant Catholic churches declare that they believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, but they're not all talking about the same church. Now, can as many churches as want to declare themselves to be the one, the true church? Yes, for religious purposes, they can all do it. But for property purposes, it's one church. And for the corporation, which is the one that owns all the property, it says if there's a dispute about who the bishop is of this entity, and again, remember, they couldn't elect a new bishop of this entity separate from the rules, which is calling a special convention that they're not entitled to call. Let me see. I'm almost done. I do think it's interesting they say, so for a century, you've not been able to withdraw. This is the Episcopal Church. Where did it come from? These affidavits are obviously not by historians. There must be some old popes from hundreds of years ago in Rome who are turning in their grave hearing the Episcopal Church say, oh, you can't withdraw with your property, because that's not what they said when the Episcopal Church withdrew from the Church of England. That's not what they said when the Church of England withdrew from Rome. So the deal is, it's just what do the property documents say? I'll just say briefly, this is not a case for a constructive trust, because the deal is you've got a First Amendment problem. You can't resort to equity under the neutral principles approach. Neutral principles approach is what the documents say. With that, unless the court has questions, we ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you very much. We have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. A lot was said, and I'll attempt to go quickly, but let me say that our reply brief for any questions you may have would be an excellent place to start, because all of the arguments you just heard are addressed in the appellant's reply brief. But very quickly, first, Mr. Brister said very clearly, once he went through all the documents for the diocesan trust, the trust is in favor of, quote, the parishes in union with the diocese. So that leads you to the exact same question, who is the diocese? And that is the question that Episcopal Diocese of Fort Worth, the governing law of this case, says courts cannot override the church on that question. The quote, page 652, who is or can be a member in good standing of a diocese is an ecclesiastical question. On that question alone, the court would accept the church's ruling and apply it. Now, why did the Texas Supreme Court remand if we argued these things before? Because we didn't. We argued under an old doctrine, which the Texas Supreme Court discarded, where the entire case, property issues and all, as well as the identity issues, is deferred to the church. That was the law that every court of appeals in Texas thought applied. We argued under that. The Texas Supreme Court said, no, we're adopting neutral principles. But why did they spend so much time detailing the bright red lines that civil courts cannot cross? Because those do come up on the facts on remand in neutral principles cases. And they recognized in Episcopal Diocese at that same page 652 that that might be the case here. And now we have defendant and plaintiff's agreement that it is. They say we don't start with the deeds. Absolutely we do. Article 13, not Article 14, is the document that settled the diocesan trust. It's Article 14 now, but the trust is governed by the instrument at the time of settlement, which was then Article 13. It says in favor of the parishes, and they want to read that to mean only those parishes in union with the diocese. But that doesn't change the ecclesiastical nature. It's still who is the diocese, a question civil courts cannot, under the First Amendment, override churches on. Okay, they talk about rules, and they say, well, we don't look at the rules under associations. But all the associations law cases they cite are single-tiered entities, and they only point to diocesan rules. They've completely ignored the rules of the hierarchical organization that control the lower entity. The more apt case is this court's opinion in Simpson versus Charitable Benevolent Association. That's the case that says in a tiered civil association, you look to the highest level to see what the rules governing the lower bodies are. Absolutely, the Episcopal Church could visit the diocese with the permission of the local qualified people, which they did. The presiding bishop, on consultation with the diocese under national church rules, is allowed to help select and appoint a provisional bishop. And then the provisional bishop can call a special meeting. That's all under the rules. So they're having a myopic view. They're saying, only look at our local rules and pay no attention to the Constitution and canons that we, quote, fully acceded to as a condition of formation. Again, they talk a lot about the corporation. The corporation is just the trustee. If we are the beneficiaries, the trustee is irrelevant. And then they talk about we don't look at the deeds. There are 55 deeds in the record, which I cited the court to, that say that the property is in express trust for, quote, the Protestant Episcopal Church, comma, within the territory now known as the Diocese of Dallas, end quote. That would now be the Diocese of Fort Worth, but what hasn't changed is the Protestant Episcopal Church. Those 55 deeds cannot mean people who left and disavowed the Protestant Episcopal Church. There is no reasonable or rational reading that construes those deeds in that fashion. And yet the trial court erred because it completely ignored those 55 deeds. So when they say you need to start with the deeds, we agree. And we would ask this court to render the judgment that would have honored and enforced those deeds. Finally, on Shelburg, that was the law in effect. The Texas Supreme Court did not take up Shelburg. They offered a guiding opinion on defendant's position, which is whether the irrevocable trust that the diocese made to the Episcopal Church in 1983 was sufficient under Property Code Section 112 with express language of irrevocability. The Texas Supreme Court said, no, that language is not sufficient. But that's not inconsistent with our argument, which is that under neutral principles of law, Property Code Section 112 does not apply to a contractual trust. That's this court's preeminent Shelburg case, cited by Stanley Johansson for 40 years since as a leading case on Section 112. When a trust is bargained for in exchange for consideration, which is the minority of trusts, most are gratuitous, but this is a trust bargained for in exchange for consideration, which was the right for the diocese to form in the first place. The church said you may form, but in exchange you have to hold the property in trust. That makes it irrevocable. That was the law in effect at the time. As Justice Dofano said in a sister case, that's the law that governs this irrevocable trust. So on that, we ask this court respectfully to reverse and render an enter judgment for plaintiffs. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess that concludes the oral arguments. The case is submitted. And we will close for the day. I think that's